From my perspective, I think that we just live in a really stressed out society. Cities are complex environments. We place too many demands on people in cities, whether they're driving or riding a bike or walking or using a wheelchair.
More than half of the people on this planet live in cities. And depending on who you ask, this could be a good thing or a bad thing. This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today, we're talking about cities, how they affect us mentally, and how we can design better cities that support, rather than erode, our mental health and well-being. I'm joined by Dr. Robin Mazunder. Robin is an environmental neuroscientist whose work seeks to understand how our minds and wellness are impacted by the experience of living and being in cities. His work challenges us to recognize diversity in the human experience, so that we can figure out what's wrong with our cities and make it right. This is a fascinating angle on a critical issue if cities are indeed going to be a part of the solution to the many challenges we face as a global society. Let's dig in. I'm just thrilled to be joined today by Robin Mazunder. Robin is a neuroscientist, but not a neuroscientist who works on brains per se. Robin uses his science to help design cities that support well-being, equity, and our planet. Robin, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I feel like we have to start with the obvious question. How does neuroscience relate to cities?
Well, fundamentally, I think that cities are complex environments, and how we experience them and understanding how we experience them is important to making, you know, evidence-informed decisions as to the design. And, you know, there are a number of ways that neuroscience can be used to understand people's experience of cities, from, you know, wearable EEGs, so encephaloelectrography, which is the little caps people wear sometimes in the hospital to get some diagnostic work done, but we can use it to understand what's happening in people's brains in different environments, which is what we did with a study in Edmonton with some people from the University of Alberta, Kyle Matthewson's lab, and we measured how people responded to different levels of cycling infrastructure and what happened in their brains. So, you know, that gave us some understanding of the attentional needs, and maybe, you know, from my perspective, I think that we place too many demands on people in cities, whether they're driving or riding a bike or walking or using a wheelchair. And by quantifying the attentional demands or the stress, we might be able to actually advocate with the, you know, municipalities to say the human being just isn't capable of riding a bike down the street with all these cars at this time of day. So we need infrastructure. Other studies we've done involve measuring people's electrodermal activity. So that's the rate at which you sweat emotionally, and it's a good indicator of stress. And so we see how people respond to different types of public art or different levels of traffic, or being, you know, for my dissertation, being the presence of skyscrapers, to see how that imposing effect can shape people's psychologies. So that's, I guess, a little overview of ways in which neuroscience can help us to build better cities. And I guess just to sum it up, we're increasingly in need of evidence-based design. And I think that cities, while I'm sure most of it was well-intentioned, are actually probably poorly designed and not too conscious of the diversity of experiences that can come into play in them.
I see. And those are really great examples. I can think to my own personal experiences of being in bike lanes in cities where it almost seemed unmanageable, and being able to actually measure that is not something I had ever thought of. As I was reading about your work, a lot of it focuses on public spaces in cities, right?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in the spaces that we share with others.
And this is something that I feel like more and more people are talking about too, that not everybody experiences public spaces in the same way. A moment ago, you mentioned people in wheelchairs, other people who cope with some sort of perhaps disability or accessibility need that the sidewalks aren't made for. I know Indigenous people often experience a lot of cultural, social stigma when they're in parks or public spaces. And so people are experiencing cities differently. And so you've raised this idea of experiential equity or inequity.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an example of experiential inequity that might help people understand what that means or maybe flies under people's radar?
Yeah, I mean, so just first to really define experiential equity, I mean, it's pretty obvious in the name. It's considering equity in people's experiences. But the reason that I use that terminology was to build on existing terminology that gets at equity in cities, which is called distributional equity. And so the notion is that if you were to, you know, A, it's recognizing that certain communities lack access to specific types of infrastructure, like good public space, parks, or cycling infrastructure. And so that if you make that equitable, then you're solving all of the problems of society, right? So it's about access. And so what I put forward is access alone isn't going to be a determinant of health, and that access can be impeded by police surveillance, security. So people of color, particularly Black people and Indigenous people, as you mentioned, are routinely stopped and harassed by the police. And so if a police officer is in a park, for one person, they might see that as a good thing, as a sign of safety, whereas someone else can see that as a very dangerous threat to them, as demonstrated to us in the news for the past however many years that this has actually been documented. Police surveillance and just security in general, I think, can be one detractor of equity, obviously. But something else that I think is a bit more insidious is just this continual use of defensive or hostile architecture. So hostile architecture refers to a design process that basically excludes certain people from spaces. And this primarily can be targeted towards homeless people in our cities. So, you know, homeless spikes are things that exist, which is mind-blowing to me. Or, you know, designing park benches to be really uncomfortable to lie down on or impossible to lie down on. And so, you know, I think that these things can often fly under the radar of those who are privileged, but for others, it's very determinant of how they, you know, access and experience these pieces of public space.
I think I know what you're talking about when you say homeless spikes. You're talking about something similar to the spikes that you'd see on buildings or windows or fences to keep pigeons off, say.
Yeah, it's amazing. I can't believe that people designed and or paid for that, you know.
I'm thinking here of a conversation I had earlier this season with Chef Mark Brand. And we were talking about unhoused people in cities, and he commented on how transformative it would be to build or rebuild our cities around care, around taking care of people, the antithesis to what you just mentioned. So it sounds to me like you're also making something of a similar case for inclusion, for maybe radical inclusion in how we design our cities.
Yes. I mean, before my PhD, I spent 5 years working as an occupational therapist in mental health and in the community. So I actually worked quite a bit with homeless people and really firsthand saw, you know, just the consequences of this design and the absence of resources for them. But even this notion of radical inclusion, I mean, one of the reasons that I was motivated to leave my clinical practice to do something else was because I was frustrated with how much emphasis was placed on medicating people for issues that could perhaps be in part addressed by design that promoted social inclusion. Because a lot of the people that I worked with, particularly adults with developmental disabilities, were just profoundly lonely. And so I saw that not as an issue of something that the medical establishment could really address meaningfully. It was really a question of how we can design our cities to make sure that we just are naturally moving towards other people in environments where we feel safe to connect.
That must have been a really interesting decision to make, to leave a professional practice and move into a very different space where you're trying to develop insights and knowledge to build better policy.
I just got fed up. You know, I just didn't see the real solution being discussed and increased urgency to discharge our patients so that we can get more people on our rosters and maybe see them a couple of times. So that didn't really jive much with, I guess, my values. And I actually left to work for the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology to help them developed their startup accelerator, which is a completely different direction than anything I'd done. But as part of that, the training for that role, I learned about design thinking from the Stanford D School, which is really, you know, based on using an empathic approach to design and understanding the user's needs. And that was when one of the other light bulbs went off for me, which is how do we truly identify or empathize with people within an urban context? And so that's what motivated me to do my PhD in neuroscience, because that was my understanding of the best way to really understand what's happening for someone, you know, from a quantitative perspective.
There's an intersection here that I want to get to, and I'm curious to hear how you, from the way that you work and think about urban environments, and then the way that many people also think about environment as the you know, the nature, the green thing, the many people think the not city, right?
Right. Away from the city.
Exactly. But cities are environments. And an ecologist will tell you that cities have ecosystems. And one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I talk about this in my own book, is that a way that we could improve urban environments, both for ourselves and for the rest of the world, is to let diversity, let the messiness of the wild back in a little bit, that cities are so controlled and scripted and structured in a way that just attends to the needs of maybe the mean, the average individual, but not the diverse kinds of experiences and perspectives and physical abilities and lives that people live. So I'm curious to hear what you think about this idea that what we're trying to do, if we want to improve cities, that we need to let them be a little bit more messy, let the wild back in.
I agree. I mean, my dad's actually an ecologist, so I grew up in ecology labs, and really, I think the orientation to ecosystems informed my approach to my own research. So I really believe in the interconnectedness of all things, including our infrastructure and the people and the animals, and that the highly ordered way in which, I mean, in some ways highly ordered, but really controlled, I would say, as you said, approach to cities is inhibiting. And arguably, I mean, if we were to believe in the biophilia hypothesis, I think put forward by E.O. Wilson, we need to be close to nature, but nature has to be allowed to be itself, I think, for it to be really truly effective. And I think one other maybe interesting thing is that within the environmental psychological research on how green space can benefit us, one of the key elements put forward by two of the dominant theories, which is attention restoration theory and stress restoration theory, is that there needs to be an element of being away. If these spaces or parks are seen as kind of prosthetics or curatives or something to help us take a break from the city, then I think that says a lot about why they're designed the way they are,
as opposed to how they might be.
Yeah, I think that something else to consider too is that, and I'm not the first person to point this out, but I think highly manicured, highly controlled green spaces is another expression of colonialism. Mm-hmm.
And one that rarely works as well for our non-human neighbors as something that was less manicured, more fluid, more connective through, as opposed to little parceled out sections that you get to visit, no different than a zoo. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's research that suggests that diversity of flora and fauna is actually associated with higher restoration values. So, you know, and arguably this is tied just to the human attunement to complexity and novelty. You know, one park with one type of tree and no animals versus one with life, I think, would be less effective. Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking now, as we keep sort of butting up against the notion of design and not just problems, but solutions. And cities are really this contested space, depending on who you talk to. Some people see them as the epitome of the problems. They create heat islands. They depend on resources from the hinterlands, quote unquote. But a lot of people then offer the counterpoint that they can be major solutions to so many of these environmental challenges we face as a planet. They can be efficient. They can have public transit. They can be great if they're well designed for cycling, high density housing, and so forth. I'm curious, wanting to keep this conversation about what's possible, do you have an example of a city or something from a city that you think is really innovative and an example of what's possible?
Yeah, I mean, there's many, but I think the first that comes to mind is Barcelona. I was there in 2018, and I was staying with a friend that I actually met at a cycling conference I spoke at in Moscow, and he was the Alvaro Nicolas is his name, and he helped design or inform the design of something called the Superblocks. Are you familiar with that? So Superblocks are basically they're a repurposing of street space to promote social connection and just places for kids to play. And, you know, I think it's a very, I'm saying easy to implement relative to all the other forms of infrastructure development in the city, but, you know, overnight, arguably. And it provided, you know, kids with space to play in high density neighborhoods. It addressed noise pollution. It addressed sound pollution. And I think in conjunction with their, I would say, relative to most Canadian cities, good cycling infrastructure, it seemed to me that they were very aware of what the challenges that were coming ahead and had to make some decisions that was documented to, you know, bother some people, particularly people who wanted to be able to drive down those streets or park their cars there. But now I think it's been adopted quite widely across the city and is seen as like as a win.
So, yeah, it was perhaps there were some concessions or some adaptations that people needed to make to the change, but it wasn't a win-loss. It sounds like it was a win-win-win-win.
Yeah, totally. And it's something that, you know, they're getting attention for and other cities around the world are trying to emulate.
So I have just one more question for you, continuing on this topic of solutions and optimism. And it's something that I ask everyone at the end of the episodes. And given that cities are in some ways mechanisms or structures of exclusion or violence against particular groups of people, but they also have this opportunity to be the location of solutions. That to me means that they are a place where radical change is possible, perhaps desirable, depending on who you ask. What's a radical change you would like to see in our cities or how we think about or design or manage our cities?
Yeah, so I don't think this will ever happen, but it's so then I guess it's definitionally radical. But I just think that wherever there's a road, there should be a separated bike lane.
I was going to say, it just like I have to comment on the fact that that's radical.
Yeah, I remember going to Copenhagen and just seeing bike lanes on side streets. And I was like, what the hell? Like, how is, you know, this would have taken like 20 years to get in, you know, on a main road in Canada, in Canadian city. And there just was not even an issue. Not to say they don't have their challenges with, you know, the car culture there, but I'm just confused by how, in again, using Canadian cities as an example, where we have large roadways, really, really big roadways, we have actually access to spaces and freedom to work with space that a lot of cities in Europe don't, just because of the way that those cities were built kind of pre-car. So, you know, we have this abundance of space and we can easily accommodate all forms of transportation, but it's literally an uphill battle to establish the, you know, the case for these, for something as simple as a physical barrier that would help people keep people safe.
You make a really good point there that I just want to follow on a little. We have more to work with than some older cities that were built for smaller modes of transportation, which is, it's, on one sense, it's a resource. So then it begs the question of what's the barrier? And the barrier seems to be attitudes, established habits. And I think of the pandemic when restaurants first started opening and taking over the cities because outdoor dining, this happened in Guelph. I know it happened in a number of different places. Outdoor dining was the only game in mm-hmm. town. You know, main drags were shut down. People were happy because they were out again. And then now there's this desperate attempt to not let it slide back, right? To not have to give that space back to parked cars. And for me, that brings up this notion of sometimes you just need a little bit of disruption. And to get people to see what's alternatives that are possible.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, change is hard. I actually went on your website and you said something about stability just looks like small change or something to that extent. You know, stability is just smaller elements of change. But I think that sometimes we need to be kind of smashed over the head to really see what's possible, because incremental change for people might actually be more painful to constantly be irritated with decisions that are being made than one decision that's made that, you know, bothers some people. And that decision, you know, I think we have to give more credit to our urban planners and municipal staff who go through years of education to then have their education and best practices to be basically denied by the general public and arguably some of, you know, elected officials. So I think we need big change, and we need you know, confident leaders to be able to implement that. When cities are run by people who are literally employed based on their popularity, like, not surprising. I had one more thought connected to that. Oh yeah. So, you know, I think one of the big issues for people when it comes to how much space we allot to bikes and how much space we allot to or don't allot to cars is probably ultimately informed by a culture of urgency and a misunderstanding of what this infrastructure can do to someone's commute to work, where they're racing to get to the daycare and they're trying to get home and then cook meals. So no one's bad in this situation. We just live in a really stressed out society. And so every possible barrier to someone being able to get something done quickly is seen as, you know, a threat.
Thanks for joining us. That was Dr. Robin Mazunder, an environmental neuroscientist who works on making cities work for everybody. The Second Transition podcast is produced on the traditional and treaty lands of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as Dish with One Spoon Territory. Support for the Second Transition podcast comes in part from the Arrow Food Institute and in part from Voicehead Radio. As always, information about our guests and their work can be found in the episode notes online. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.